Hello, I'm Michelle Carlo, and this show is Fish Out of Agua. Last week, my family found themselves trapped in the middle of a cross-apartment voodoo war, and I learned just in a nick of time that drug dealing was neither a viable or desirable career choice. Meanwhile, there was this going on across the pond in the United Kingdom. It seemed many people didn't care very much for their elected leader, Prime Minister Margaret the Milk Snatcher Thatcher. Sounds familiar to anyone? And a whole new form of what I think is protest music had arisen, mirroring the burgeoning punk movement in the United States at the same time. It remains to be seen today how or if the current U.S. political situation will be addressed musically as succinctly as this song from the Sex Pistols in 1977. It is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute, who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir. Are there no prisons? Plenty of prisons. And union workhorses. Are they still in operation? Both very busy, sir. Those who are badly off, then, must go there. But many can't go there, and many would rather die. If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. That was a quote from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which was published in 1843. Just substitute, you know who, number 45, for Scrooge, and here we could be again. I wonder if those who have ears ever heard the saying, if you don't let us dream, we won't let you sleep. There's a play by that same name, by a playwright named Anders Lustgarten. The play may have lacked drama, as one critic put it, but the sentiment doesn't. And I'm sure someone, somewhere, perhaps in our very own Brooklyn, USA, is at this very moment writing the equivalent of this song by The Clash.
Pennsylvania is bitten the dust. London calling, see, we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is within. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling, to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't wanna shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see, we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Engines stop running, the wheat is going thin. A nuclear error, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning.
With Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. We're going to mix it up a little this week and bring you our Fish Out of Agua guest artist interview for the week. Now, if you've been listening to the show, you'll know that I was born in Washington Heights and lived there for a time when I was little. And I've always been quite proud to have begun in that hood, and even prouder to know this woman, who has brought her own bit of revolution, an educational one, to that very neighborhood just a few blocks north of where I lived long ago. Take a listen. Hey, it's Michelle Carlo with Fish Out of Agua's guest interview of the week, and I'm sitting here in this clandestine little back room full of books. Oh my God, it's like total book orgasm in here. With a woman that whom I've known for about 6 years now, and she is an arts entrepreneur and an organizer and an activist and a mom, and she's an amazing lady who co-founded a little startup bookstore that was only supposed to be for 1 month in Washington Heights, and it's been about 6 years now. So please welcome to Fish Out of Agua, Veronica Liu.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm happy to be here.
Oh my God, that was like the biggest introduction ever. So let's talk about how we met.
We met in, I think, the summer or fall of 2011.
Yes.
When you were doing a memoir writing workshop at the old location for Word Up Community Bookshop, which is the bookstore that I started originally as a pop-up shop, but with so much community support, it kept going and going and going until we got extension after extension. And eventually, you know, next thing we knew, we'd been at that location for a year.
That's right. I remember that. I remember the one-year mm-hmm. anniversary.
Yeah. But then within those first couple of months, when we first, I think, got our, within our, you know, after our first extension, we opened in June 2011. We were supposed to close July 2011. But there, you know, as I said, there was a lot of community support. People were contacting their local politicians, who were then, you know, calling the landlord, saying, you know, we really want to support this place. Is there any way you can, you know, keep it open for a little longer? Because at that point, those first few months, we didn't we didn't pay any rent. It was actually a rent-free space that we got through, you know, a deal facilitated by Northern Manhattan Arts Alliance.
Oh.
And we had, you know, so we had this space. And we had, you know, when I started it with a group of people, a lot of different organizations and collectives and individuals I knew in the area, I said, you know, we should all come together and just make use of this space nonstop so that people really know that we need this
space. So was a bookstore first and foremost in your mind?
Was first and foremost as a thing to do.
Because let's talk about the location.
Okay, sure.
I don't think we hit home mm-hmm. hard enough on the location. The original pop-up shop, which was like some nail salon or something that you guys got like for allegedly only 1 month, was on Broadway around the corner from 176th Street in Washington Heights. A neighborhood that's pretty much a food desert, right? And a culture desert. You know, like, it's underserved. When I mean food desert, I don't mean, like, there's not restaurants and stuff there. But it's, like, the supermarkets. Like my mom lives up in the Bronx. And it's, like, you can find expired yogurt, but try finding a crisp apple. You know what I mean? And, like, 100, like, fast food Cuchi Frito places, but no place to get, like, produce.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've heard a lot of people refer to Washington Heights as a food desert. I don't know if I would totally agree, because I think that there are places where that really do seem a lot more desert-like in terms of food access. But here, there are a lot of, grocery stores, there are a lot of, I mean, besides restaurants, there are a lot of, just even, like, fruit carts and stuff. Like, there's actually, I think there's a lot, but, and there are several green markets that pop up at different times.
That's now, but I mean, but historically the neighborhood was not. Right. I mean, I was born on 156th Street, 157th and Broadway, and there was like nada.
Yeah, but I think even for, you know, I've lived, you know, in the area for 15 years. I think even in that time, there are a lot of like places to access food relative to other spots that I think I would be even more considered food deserts. But, and then in terms of culture deserts, I think that's the thing where I actually found that this place was like brimming with culture makers, people who were, you know, audience members, people who were creating things.
So many artists live up here because the rent is still kind of affordable.
It was the spaces that were lacking. So it wasn't so much that it was that there was no culture. It's just that it was happening and you know, there was so much happening still, even really in people's living rooms and in their bedrooms.
Yes, and
spaces are traditionally necessarily.
And when I mean culture, what I mean specifically, which I probably should say, is not culture per se, but books. Like food for the soul. The closest bookstore before you opened up was like Lincoln Center, probably. Unless there was a Barnes & Noble like way up in Inwood or something.
There were a couple of Spanish language bookstores in Inwood, but one had closed in 2008, another closed early 2012. There was a Columbia Medical, you know, school textbook store that was close by. That's like a Barnes & Noble, basically. Right. And there is Sisters Uptown, which is 156.
Right. That's true. That's true.
And then there was another bookstore, Jamel Terrace Books, that was open only by appointment or serendipity.
Oh, wow.
But in terms of having, you know, something that was open quasi-regular hours, like really central to the neighborhood and, you know, with an event schedule, you know, a space for events, I think that there was a need for it. There are almost 200,000 people that live above 155th Street. It's a very densely populated area.
Yes.
So even if there were a lot of bookstores, I think that this place could absorb even more. And also we really, even though we were most visibly a bookstore and, you know, really are anchored by the books and what they represent and the sort of exchange of the mind that they provide. We also, you know, we're basically a community center in disguise. You know, we have the events that we do are, you know, beside, you know, we've done a lot of workshops. Yours being one of the early ones, like it was a memoir writing workshop, I think, for kids. Even.
Yes, I remember that. It was shortly after my book, Fish Out of Agua, came out. And I think, I don't know how I came upon your name. It was a serendipitous day, but I remember calling and asking, would you like to do this event? And you guys said, yeah. And I went up and did it. And like the rest is history. And like, I'm still working with you guys years later.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be happier.
Yeah. And I think the longest running event we have on the calendar, because we, you know, we were open for about a year at that original location, then we closed, and then did just, you know, events around the neighborhood while we fundraised and looked for more, another, you know, location. And then we opened again in 2013. So I've been at this location now for almost 4 years.
Yeah.
But the one event that is
carried through since the old location and has been the most consistent is No Name.
Yeah, the
There
No
is
Name.
No other event that has been as consistent as No Name.
That's amazing. No Name is a performance collective run by a man named Eric Vedder, who's been doing producing shows for God, like, totally over 20 years, and I'm lucky enough to be part of it. I curate and host a monthly storytelling segment, which I'm going to be doing a little bit later after this interview. But one of the things that I, two things that I really love about Word Up, A, the fact that you opened up a freaking bookstore where there was no bookstore, but B, you were bilingual from the get-go. You were English-Spanish from the get-go.
We had Russian books represented a lot that's in true. That first location, too.
Then multilingual. Then I stand corrected. Multilingual from the get-go. And the other thing that I admire so much is that the grassroots activism that surrounded you guys to keep you from being evicted when after your supposed one-month term was up. You said that there were community activists involved and people like went to the local politicians. So so that kind of thing works. Do you see that, people? If you like protest and or like try to get together to make something happen, it does happen. Yeah. It can happen.
Well, I think it really, the fact that once we were there and
at the local level, man, that's like fresh shit. Yo, give me a yo. Give me, yeah, that is like the freshest shit.
Yeah, I think one thing that became obvious once we opened was that we were filling a need that a lot of people didn't even, you know, a lot of people realized that that need was there, but other people who hadn't even realized that that gap was there.
Right.
Suddenly like, could see it because
like,
of
like you
because
don't know
we were filling
that you
it.
Love it and you want this until you've had it because it's like growing up without a parent. You don't know what it's like to grow
exactly.
up without a parent, so you don't miss the void until you meet somebody who kind of like will take the place, like an in-law or an auntie or something, and then you realize that it's not the same, that there's still like this void there.
Yeah, I mean, something that happened right before we, like, you know, about a year before we opened, a year and a half, was the library that's actually closer to the second location. The library, the Washington Heights branch library, had closed for renovations for a year and a half. And it was supposed to be a year and a half, actually, but it was closed for 3 or 4 years. So we opened in the middle of that, and we, you know, not right away, but we had some kids coming through, you know, who had known the library and then it didn't have access to it, or, you know, weren't trekking to the other library, or kids who just didn't even have the experience of a library because their school library was being used as a classroom. There are a lot of co-located schools in this area. There's a lot of like overcrowding. And so sometimes two or three schools are located in the same building. And sometimes when that happens, the first room that's sacrificed is the library.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, people were coming, administrators from the schools were coming over and saying, oh, look at this place. Look, you know, it's run by volunteers. There's books everywhere. Can you guys come over to our library and try and help us do something with it? I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? Because, you know, it's
help
just like,
you.
Yeah. We're like a bunch of neighbors who pulled together to open this bookstore and art space. But, you know, different, you know, groups of us would go and to, you know, with the assistant principal or the principal to these schools. And we'd see the situation, which is that sometimes there was a library, but no like checkout system or no, it had been used as a classroom for so long or as like a flex room. Or, you know, in some cases there were really nice libraries, but there were no librarians because of just cuts in that realm. And it was, it seemed, and it still seems actually preposterous to some level that, you know, this huge group of volunteers is being approached when, you know, librarianship is a thing. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You can go to school to be a librarian. Yeah, there's a lot to
I
know
I have a friend that spent a lot of money
access.
Getting her master's at Pratt for it, like a lot of money, and she's working now.
Yeah.
But like, one of the other things that I think is so cool about Word Up is that you're completely volunteer run.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you're just like the most cooperative co-op type of thing ever. It's like everybody like has a part in it.
Yeah.
Is this the vision that you had a couple of partners in the beginning? I remember a woman named Inju and I remember a woman named Marianne. Mm-hmm. At one point there were the three of you together. Was this kind of like what you envisioned, or did this concept of the bookstore / art space / community center like take off in a way that you didn't expect?
Oh, it definitely took off in a way we didn't expect. A lot of the people who I've worked with now, I really just met after Word Up opened, or the week that Word Up was opening, or, you know, I think there are some people among the core group who have still been around since then. But, you know, I think the great part about this being, having been a volunteer-run thing, is that, you know, it's like a self-selecting thing. All the people that gather are, and have, you know, help build Word Up are people who all want it to exist, who all need a place to be sort of communing with their neighbors over, and it in a space that isn't necessarily like overtly commercial,
right,
or is pressuring you to buy something in order to sit and talk to somebody.
Like someone could come in here and do their homework.
Oh, definitely.
Someone could just like come in here and just like browse some books and sit at a table and read because they want to get out of the cold right. for a half an hour.
Yeah, we're very similar to a library in that way, except that, you know, I think there's even a little more freedom. Like you can talk a little louder, you can do, yeah. you know, in certain spaces. There's like a casualness to it, and a lot of the stuff that's around is... Yeah. You know, there's art. It seems very homemade here. If you've ever, you know, if you should come visit the
space. You'll come visit on the corner of 165th and Amsterdam.
Yes. And wordupbooks.com is like where you can get the information on the hours. But yeah, it's the whole sort of library feeling that makes me feel like I worry that there's right now a proposal on the table that the Inwood Library might close for a short time in order to for there to be, you know, like a housing development to be built like in conjunction with it. And in the meantime, you know, the library would be sort of moved to a storefront. And I feel like that seems so similar to what happened with, you know, the branch that's near here, except that what we found is that we couldn't even absorb all of the, you know, everything that was going on, everything that people were requesting, everything that people needed. I mean, there's no way even still we've been able to sort of fill that need, even as this like very vibrant, very, you know, enlarging group, you know, ever-growing group of volunteers who can fill this space. If anything, we need both, you know, fully functioning libraries at all times, but also more bookstores and more storefronts, more gathering spaces.
Now, let me ask you a question. As a mom, what do you feel about, do you feel that education is being threatened now with the current political climate? What do you have any concerns or worries about that? That libraries will close, bookstores will close. What are your concerns about that as a mom?
You know, there's all kinds of concerns, especially with, you know, today's confirmation of Betsy DeVos. But
today is February 7th.
But you know, I think
2017,
yeah, there are so many more considerations I've made, you know, for all of these things I've been working on for the past five and a half years because of now the existence of Lester, you know, now I have to be paying attention more to what's happening specifically in schools and with education and stuff. But at the same time, I'm glad that this place exists. I'm glad that Word Up exists, that he can grow up in a place where it's a very, very mixed group of people who, you know, mixed in terms of
everything,
you know, race, ethnicity,
age. Economic status.
Yeah, it's a really, really mixed group of people in a great way. And I think that that's really important.
Growing up and your mom is the proprietor of a bookstore, like how friggin' cool is that? You know, one of the things that I love the most of doing the storytelling show here is that, you know, Not just that I'm when Eric asked me to if I would do it, I'm like happy because like I was born in this neighborhood. I lived here in the Heights on and off till I was about 5 or 6 years old, but the thing that I love the most is that when we're doing the storytelling, like there's kids, teenagers from the neighborhood. I'm not going to mention them by name because like, but you know who I'm talking about. There were a couple of teenagers. They're here all the time, and it's so cool. I mean, these
guys
are like now they're in ninth grade, but they started coming in seventh grade. Like their teacher brought them, and like they get up and they perform at the open mic all the friggin' time, and it's just like the coolest thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the coolest thing. Like I wish that there would have been something like this in the Bronx when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's the thing that I love. I love that some kids have come in. Some kids who came when we first opened this location, and they came a lot to do homework, and then they stopped because, I don't know, they moved to, you know, to high school or something. But I've seen a couple of kids over time come in and show their friends around. And like, oh, yeah, there's this place. Oh, yeah, I used to do, you know, my homework here. Oh, yeah, you can sign the guest book here. I signed... Oh, yeah, this is a new copy of the guest book. I signed one, you know, 2 years ago. You know, and they talk about it like, you know, they're... You know, it's like old hat. You know, like they've been here, done that, and they just wanted to show you around and stuff. And I love the fact that it became such a like a mundane part of their existence,
right?
Like, because it should, you know, like hopefully this kind of stuff, you know,
books,
will infuse
books and kids.
Yeah.
It's like the best thing. It's the best thing. So, Veronica, let's wrap up here. I want to ask you two last questions before we wrap up. What is your greatest hope for Word Up in the coming few years, and what's your greatest fear?
My greatest hope is that we can become really a permanent fixture in the neighborhood. that we can be more sustainable. That might mean that we eventually have, that we're not completely volunteer run, so that somebody can be, you know, sort of raising a lot more money in our grants and running a building. But I think we all really want to have a building.
Yes. And your greatest fear?
Greatest fear?
10 words or less.
I don't know, the forces that be will somehow sort of lose the mix that we have going.
To have it all taken away, I guess.
Just like I want to really make sure that the balance is maintained and that we don't, you know, that Word Up still serves the neighborhood in terms of people that already are here, that, you know, there are people that move in all the time, but we want to make sure that we're like also serving and like amplifying the voices of people that already are here.
And once again, the address?
2113 Amsterdam Avenue, the corner of 165th Street
and
Washington
your online,
Heights.
And your online presence?
Wordupbooks.com.
With Veronica Liu. Thank you. And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. In 1978, when this next story of Fish Out of Agua happened, New York City was trying to shake off a very tumultuous year. The .44 caliber killer, also known as Son of Sam, had terrorized the city for nearly 2 years, killing 6 young people and wounding or maiming 7 others. 3 days after my birthday, the infamous blackout that left parts of the eastern seaboard without power for over 24 hours happened, and threw some neighborhoods into a decline it took decades to reverse, if at all. In October of that year, during Game 2 of the World Series between the New York Yankees and Brooklyn Dodgers, this exchange happened between ABC announcers Keith Jackson and Howard Cosell as one of the cameras covering the game cut to a shot of a large fire raging out of control in what was later found out to be PS3, a nearby public school. Jackson: "That's a live picture. Obviously a major fire in a large building in the South Bronx region of New York City." "That's a large picture. That's a live picture. And obviously the fire department in the Bronx have there a problem. My goodness, that's a huge blaze." Cosell: "That's the very area President Carter trod just a few days ago." About 9 minutes later, the camera showcased the fire again. Howard Cosell: "That's a live shot again of that fire in the South Bronx that Keith called to your attention just a few moments ago. Wonder how many alarms are involved. But as Keith said, the fire department really has its work cut out for it. I'm Howard Cosell, speaking of sports." But urban legend would soon take that over. And soon, many people, countless people, all over would swear on their hair that they heard Howard Cosell say on national television, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning." Can't make that up. Also in 1978, just 2 months later, New York City went from burning to frozen in the great Northeast blizzard of 1978, which buried the northeastern United States from New Jersey up to Massachusetts that February, with hurricane-force winds in more than 2 feet of snow for an unprecedented 33 hours from February 5th through the 7th. No AccuWeather back then, kids, so people had little, if any, time to prepare. Today, the subways get shut down for a flurry, and schools are closed for much less of a snowfall. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Years from now, people are going to wonder how the hell any of us who grew up back then survived it all. Luckily, we had music to make up for it, like these songs from Forest Hills' very own The Ramones. We'll be right back. those two songs from the Ramones were referencing things from back in the day, both of them. Pinhead, Todd Browning's Freaks, a movie from 1932, which was about pinheads and other performers that I believe were in a circus. I haven't seen this movie for a long time, but they were considered freaks until they weren't. And they actually turned someone who was like their main tormentor into one of them. I remember going to see that movie at Theater 80 on St. Mark's Place. Theater 80 is still there now. It's still a theater, but it used to be a revival movie house that would show like the same genre of movies like throughout the year at the same time. So let's just say, well, in the winter, they'd be showing 1930s Before the Code movies. And we used to go all the time. And well, there's still Film Forum today that does revivals. So at least that still exists in New York. And then after that was 53rd and 3rd, which was about the corner of 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue in Manhattan, which was known as a male hustler spot back in the day. Today, that corner of 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue is where the Citibank building is. And it's kind of hard to imagine hustling going on in that corner today, isn't it? Well, but then again, who knows what goes on in Manhattan at night? Hell, who knows what goes on in Manhattan at all? I certainly didn't. At least not really when this next story of Fish Out of Agua happens. And here we go with chapter 27 of Fish Out of Agua. It's a story called Heat. The year 1977 had been a pivotal year for New York City. We had survived the blackout. Son of Sam was finally caught. Reggie Jackson, also known as Mr. October, became a candy bar. And to top the year off, right before Christmas, the boiler in my family's apartment building exploded. It burned out the ground floor apartment directly above and left the rest of the double building without heat or hot water for the entire winter, precipitating a grassroots tenants organization, a rent strike, and perhaps maybe a slight spike in the building's birth rate the following September. Well, to me, that was the least of it. Because unless you grew up so far north that living in a 5-story igloo was considered normal, you cannot imagine the multitude of misery entailed with living through a no heat and no hot water New York City winter. The indignity of taking sponge baths in the kitchen behind a makeshift curtain and watching the ice inside the window melt while your father and brother hollered at you to hurry up was horrible. Especially when in the middle of this sponge bath, you got your period. Or imagine the smell a 4-room apartment takes on after the oven has been on at 400 degrees every single day for over a month. And then you get your period again. And meanwhile, while my younger brother Kevin and I were going to bed every night looking like refugees, wearing every sweater we had, 3 pairs of socks, and these fingerless gloves my father had made us, my mother tooled around in shorts and a t-shirt. She had her own personal combustion system keeping her warm that year, a continuous hot flash that lasted basically the entire winter. You could actually stand next to her and feel it. And not only did she not complain, but she was not fazed one little bit at being at least 5 years too young for this middle-age milestone. Nope, Mom declared it was God's will that gave her the change of life that year as opposed to any other. And since she seemed to be so cool with it, Kevin and I gave her an orange t-shirt for Valentine's Day. It was from the neighborhood head shop, and it had a lightning bolt iron-on on the front that said, Hot Mama. She didn't think it was funny. And of course, it was all my fault. Wait till this happens to you, she said as she threw her chancletas, her slippers, at me. You think you're going to be young forever? Get out of my sight! Well, yeah, I was almost 18, well, 17 and a half. And at that point in my life, I did actually think I was going to be young forever. And I certainly didn't mind going out, as it was actually warmer at the park than it was in the apartment. So when I got to the park, to the playground, to St. Peter's Park, my friends were crowded around the neighborhood nut job, Crazy Mayree. None of us really liked Mayree, but she had started hanging out at the park a couple of years before, and everyone let her because everyone was kind of afraid of her. She had bleached blonde bangs, Clairol, not Clorox like Nikki years before. She had a tattoo of a scorpion, her astrological sign, on her chest bone, and six, count them, six piercings in her left ear, at a time when even the most rebellious girl among us only wore three earrings, that would have been me, and when the only acceptable girl tattoos were the Led Zeppelin IV Zofo symbols, butterflies, and roses, either on your shoulder blade or adorning your right or left hip bone. Every time Mayree got stoned, she would walk around saying she was a tree. And once she took some blotter acid, and she sat on the ground and chanted the names of every species on the eastern seaboard. Plus, she wouldn't listen to Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, or even The Who anymore. And she was always trying to get us to go downtown with her, to Manhattan, to hang out. None of my friends went to Manhattan to go out in those days, unless it was to Madison Square Garden, a Dr. Pepper concert in Central Park, or Lazarium, the rock and laser light show at the Hayden Planetarium. The closest most of us had ever been to a real rock club were the Blood Bars on Valentine Avenue where Twisted Sister used to play. And they sucked. Ah, and then there was Detroit, up in Port Chester. Yeah, people used to go up there to see Rat Race Choir. Only, they kind of sucked, too. Mayree looked up from the joint she was lighting and said, "Oh, come on, guys, man. We have to go to heat. The club is so hot. The bands are so hot. The guys are so hot. And Johnny Thunders is playing tonight. Whoa, man, he is so hot. Come on, man. Don't be faggots. Who's coming with me?" All I heard was the name. Heat. I didn't know who or what Johnny Thunders was, and I didn't care. The frozen core of my brain pictured a Hawaiian-themed palace with bikinis, thatched umbrellas, and flaming drinks. It didn't matter that I wouldn't be legal, 18, for another 5 months. Huh, all I needed were my high heels and my fake ID. And then I could be warm. "I'll go," I said.
"Wicked," Mayree said. "Meet me here at 7 o'clock, show. Yeah."
Nikki and Dawn couldn't believe it.
"What, are you crazy? You don't know what they do in Manhattan."
I didn't care if they tattooed and pierced their totos. All I thought was that after 2.5 months of freezing, I was finally going to be warm. And I didn't dare tell Mayree that this would be the first time I'd go into Manhattan by myself. Well, without a crowd. With just one other person. I met Mayree at 7 o'clock that night. We smoked a bone and hopped on the No. 6 train. And the entire ride downtown, Mayree talked about seeing bands I had never heard of, with people I didn't know, and how the second she turned 18, she was going to go live in the village. Good for you, I said. But I thought, oh, come on, man, I just want to get some heat and go home. Finally, we got off the train at Bleecker Street, and I had no idea where we were. The surrounding neighborhood wasn't the 21st century so hopeless shopping mall East Soho is today. Nope, it was dark, it was scary, and it was dirty. Of course it was. Only artists and drug dealers dared to live there. After slipping along slushy cobblestone side streets in my open-toed candies, the only high heels I had, which I was wearing with tube socks, because even I wasn't going to go barefoot in February, Mayree had changed direction, cursing, several times, until finally she grabbed my hand and changed direction again, uptown, downtown, east, west. I had lost all sense of direction until suddenly Marie grabbed my hand once more and steered me through a doorway. If this was a club, it was narrow and it stank. It was dark and it was freezing. A slightly chubby older girl with bleach blonde hair and hairy armpits, who was making a big show of not checking IDs at the door wearing her wife-beater T-shirt, asked me where I got her gloves, my gloves. My dad made them, I said, as I staggered past her and to a long, black, crowded bar towards a dim yellow light at the end of the room, towards salvation, warmth. You don't understand. I had been continuously cold for about 3 months, and my Caribbean DNA leaves me predisposed to lying naked and indolent under palm trees, not wearing my entire winter wardrobe in a cold bar that smelled like hot piss. As I got to the stage, I got a glimpse of the singer. He was short, he was skinny, and he was nodding out against the mic stand. His mouth and fly were both wide open, and his entire penis was just hanging out. And I mean hanging, basically. Just hanging there, like right in front of my face. And I had never seen a naked adult penis that close before. It looked much bigger than what I had ever felt through my clothes the few times I had actually made out with a boy. At first, the sight was kind of scary, but then again, after I took another look, I had to admit, Mayree was right. If this was Johnny, whoever he was kind of hot. But as I leaned in for a closer look, I heard yelling, and I reluctantly turned around to see Mayree fist fighting with the biggest, ugliest woman I had ever seen in my life. "Oh, come on, baby," the woman said. "I wouldn't have worn a dress if I knew I was going to see you tonight. Look, look what Mama got for you." And then she lifted her pink and black, satin and lace, Laverne and Shirley-looking prom dress to reveal the second naked adult penis I had ever set my eyes on. Mayree yelled, "Rah! Get away from me, faggot!" And then the whatever it was ripped off a long, tangled blonde wig and took off the biggest pair of candies I had also ever seen. "Who you calling faggot, faggot?" she yelled, and then she threw the shoes at us. I didn't have time to be shocked. All I could process was that I had gone all the way to Manhattan just to have another crazy person throw footwear at me. I tried to turn back to the stage where the still-exposed singer had now fallen over, but Mayree grabbed me by the hand and pulled me through the club back out into the street. "Wait, Mayree, wait! I lost my gloves," I said. "Well, fuck your gloves. You want to get killed?" Mayree yelled from two steps ahead of me. And that's when I saw there were three of them chasing us now. Three of the biggest, ugliest creatures I had ever seen, wearing ripped-up 1950s prom dresses and moth-eaten furs, cursing and throwing their shoes. Luckily, one of them fell over a garbage can, and they gave up the chase to help their friend, still screaming, "Who you calling faggot, faggot?" I took one last look behind me, and I saw the white awning above the door said, CBGB OMFUG. When we got back to Bleecker Street train station, I asked Mayree, CBGBs? I thought the place we were going to was called Heat.
"Yeah, man, well, I forgot where it was, so we went to CB's instead."
"Oh.
And who was that?"
I asked, meaning the passed out with his cock out guy on the stage.
"What, man, you never seen a tranny before?"
"Huh?
Tranny, you know, transvestites, he-she's, TVs, fucking bunch of man-hooers."
She paused and then said,
"Girl, you gotta get out of the Bronx more."
Actually, I never wanted to leave the Bronx ever again. When I got home, My mother was in the downstairs in the building lobby waiting for me. The trains had been slow, and I was over an hour past curfew. She pushed me up the stairs ahead of her.
"Do you know what time it is? Where have you been?"
"Hanging out with Mayrie and a TV." She took off her chancleta and swatted it at me. I didn't care. It was the truth. And the slipper, at least, was warm. A few years later, I was at a video club called the Cat Club with Mayrie, who had become one of the few people from St. Peter's Park I was still friends with. She pointed to the screen and said,
"Hey, Shao, doesn't that look like that girl in that club that night?"
I looked up, expecting to see a tranny. They were no big deal to me anymore. Hey, I was going to art school. But instead, there was a much thinner, much blonder, much less hairy version of that non-ID-checking girl writhing on a boat in a canal, wearing a wedding dress and fingerless gloves. Was it? Could it have been? The same girl who had complimented my homemade gloves, thanks to my dad, at that club door years before? Could it be that maybe I unwittingly gave away the hottest trend of the 1980s on a cold winter night in 1978 in a club I thought was called Heat? I'll never really know for sure. But what I do know is that my mother would later find out she had been suffering that winter, not from menopause, but from the side effects of one of her latest meds, and would not go through actual menopause for another 5 years. And, maybe coincidentally, and maybe not, but also after that winter, she now only would speech out the window, or in the house, a few times a year. In any case, I know that she has saved the orange T-shirt with the lightning bolt for me for when my time of heat comes. I know that time is soon, and sometimes, on a really chilly night, I can almost feel it, and it makes me think of, yeah, there was a time when I thought I was going to be young forever. I would get to see Johnny Thunders a couple of years later, but by then, things weren't the same with him or with me. In memory of John Anthony Genzel from East Elmhurst and Jackson Heights, rest in peace. And this song is You Can't Put Your Arms Around a Memory from 1978. Ooh, baby,
damn.
that's our show. This has been Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like what you heard today, sponsor us. You could do it for as little as a dollar per episode, almost as much as an entire pint of beer cost back in 1978, people. Just go to the Fish Out of Agua page on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com, click on the green Sponsor the Show button, green for money, and let Patreon take care of the rest. Stay tuned for Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we'll leave you with this song that would perfectly capture how I would be feeling by the end of this year. Blank Generation from Richard Hell, who actually you will see appear in a later episode. See yous next week.
But I can take it or leave it each time.